Well, welcome everybody. It's Tuesday morning and we're engaged in the study of the Dharma. And in this particular instance, we're looking at the mind of enlightenment, which is called our bodhicitta. So our class is about the development of that and primarily how it sort of is dependent on what is called a mind of equanimity. So that's what we're basically talking about today. So we begin these classes by often taking. We always take refuge together and generate the mind of enlightenment. Then the class begins, and throughout the class there are pause moments whereby you can ask questions that have arisen. If the question is sort of overwhelming or comes straight to you straight away, just raise your hand. I'll stop and I'll do my best to answer. Otherwise, just wait for that part. And then there's also a part for meditating in. Okay, so let's begin. So the first thing is for you guys to be sitting comfortably. So it requires that your feet are like flat on the floor or on a cushion, that your back is straight. And you can place your hands wherever you like. And as for your eyes, you can keep them completely natural, just like mine are, and yours are right now. Or you can close them partially so that just a little bit of light comes in, or you can close them completely, whatever suits you. Okay, and just check also that your shoulders are dropped down. And once you are sitting comfortably, just check that you are. And once you're certain you are, just let the body breathe itself. And while the body breathes itself, focus upon the movements that take place in the body as you inhale and exhale. And feeling comfortable and at ease. Imagine that in the space in front of you appears Shakyamuni Buddha, an enlightened being whose body is made of golden light. Shakyamuni Buddha is surrounded by your spiritual teachers, teachers of the lineage. Other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, there are meditational deities, there are the hearers, the solitary realizers, and there are protectors. There are a vast field of enlightened beings in space looking at you. Meanwhile, imagine that yourself is surrounded by all sentient beings. So beside you are your parents. Behind you are your closest friends. Directly in front of you are people you've had misunderstandings and difficulties with. And surrounding all of them are strangers. And all of these first people like to be happy. They want to be happy. What they don't want is to experience suffering. And yet they do. They're just like us. But you have become aware of the causes of suffering, and you know that these causes can be brought to an end through skillful means, in other words, through different methods. And also because you know that the nature of pain and suffering and anxiety aren't naturally a part of the mind. They don't inhere to the mind, in other words. They're much like dirt or mud that's in water that can be removed. Now, you know this. Many people don't. Most people don't know the nature of the mind, nor they know how to work with it. But you do. So being concerned for yourself and seeing no difference between yourself and others, you've decided to rely upon the Buddha and his teachings and his community to bring an end to your own suffering and the suffering of others. So to affirm this, join me in taking refuge and generating the mind of enlightenment by saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. In response to this prayer of yours, imagine that from the heart of the Buddha and all the enlightened beings surrounding him, lights and nectars stream out of their heart. These lights and nectars wash over you and over all the people surrounding you. And every obstacle you have to spiritual practice, to good health and good mental health, these are utterly removed. And with the abandonment of the obstacles to the mind, the four immeasurable thoughts of compassion and love and joy and equanimity arise. And you decide to establish all beings in that state. And to affirm that, join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And again, in response to this prayer of ours, lights and nectars from the heart of the Buddha and his spiritual entourage, they rain down upon us and all the people surrounding us. And every hindrance and obstacle to our practice is removed utterly. And mind returns to its open and clear nature. In recollecting the Buddha and his entourage above you as a field of merit, whereby you can develop faith and devotion. Prepare yourself to now purify the mind a little more and to increase that merit and to accumulate more merit. So now the Buddha and his companions appear to you as that field whereby you can gather all the good qualities. And facing them, you say, reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. So we've purified the mind somewhat and we've accumulated merit. Now it's important that we don't cling to the purified mind or the meritorious mind as being something that has any sort of intrinsic nature or substantial existence. So to prevent that, we imagine our body, speech, and mind is utterly transformed through our understanding of emptiness to reappear as a pure land that we can offer to the enlightened beings. And so we say, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. So our offering has been released. There's no clinging to our body, our virtue, or any object of the senses. And the Buddha accepts this offering with delight, and he looks into your eyes, and you look into his. Looking into the eyes of the Buddha, you feel at ease, accepted by him, and with some sort of confidence that whatever you're engaged in will come to fruition. But now an emanation of the Buddha leaves his heart. It moves through space, and it comes to abide above the crown of your head, but facing in the same direction you are. Now this seated emanation begins to descend, entering the crown of your head, coming down through your body, down to the level of the heart. And there it begins to expand. Your body and mind are now filled with light, which pours out through the pores of your skin, filling the 10 directions of space and transforming every being that exists within space to now be within the enlightened state. This empty vastness. And within this non-dual space, you hear the sound of the Buddha's mantra. And you join in to recite it just three times. Tayata Maharmanaya So. Tayata Maharmanaya So. Tayata Maha. You just recite this a few times under your breath. Tayata Om Muni Muni Maha Munaya Soha. So here I think you've established your own purpose and the purpose of others. Imagine that all beings have the path to enlightenment established firmly upon their awareness, and they've used this path and accomplished its goal. And now I think that this meditation we've just done is one of mainly imagination. But this imagination has imprinted the mind with conditions that support your awakening. So just rejoice in that. Take some joy in that, that this day has been made useful. And then breathe in deeply through your nostrils. Exhale through your opening mouth. And then in your own time, just let your eyes flicker open. Move your shoulders, your hands, your legs, whatever you'd like to. So again, you feel quite comfortable in your seat. So again, welcome to you all. I see a few new faces in the room. So are there these new people? Is this the first time you've been to a Buddhist center, or have you been going to them before? Long time ago. Who else is new? Is here at the back a little? So you've been here before, haven't you? Or Dharma centers? Okay. Yourself? Okay. Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you. Now, this helps me to deliver the class. I don't want to sort of talk way over your head, so you sit here and don't walk out of here with nothing. I'm afraid to help you help a little. Okay, so our class is around a topic called bodhicitta. And bodhicitta means mind of enlightenment, mind seeking enlightenment for the benefit of others. And to help me present the course, I've listened to teachings by authentic Mahayana gurus and masters. And of course, I rely a lot upon reading. So these books here, I found they're all very useful to learn about bodhicitta, but this one is the best. And it's not up there, but I'll put it up next time. I say this one is the best because it's so comprehensive. It's all in one place. So many of these other the other thing in here is really good. Meditations are in here. There's a book down here called Widening the Circle of Love, which is terrific, but it's got lots of meditations. Every stage of the path is a meditation. So if you did want to meditate on it, you'd know how to go about doing it. Other than that, in terms of readability, this book down here called A Truthful Heart, and that is really, it's a very good story because it's a person's personal development of the mind of enlightenment and very good information on the four immeasurable thoughts. Today, we're going to be looking primarily at a method for developing the mind of enlightenment called the seven cause and effect personal instructions in the lineage descended from the great elder Atisha. There's quite a mouthful there, but it's just, if you just remember, it's just the seven cause and effect instruction. Basically, in other words, it's just saying to develop the mind of enlightenment, we go through seven stages and we end up with the effect called enlightenment. Now, last week we talked about our equanimity. And so equanimity is a precursor for the development of the mind of enlightenment. So in other words, if we don't develop our equanimity, it'll be very difficult or impossible, in fact, to develop the mind of enlightenment. So we spent the whole last week talking about equanimity, and we'll still talk about it a little bit today. Now, last week I talked about how many types of equanimity did I mention last week, folks, but those of you here? Three. Fantastic. Good. Yep, there was three. So what was the first one? Can you remember that? An equanimity sort of based on or concerning our feelings. That was the first one, right? And it just means that the mind is sort of neutral. So this is called equanimity. So what does that mean? It means if you look at the two ways the mind can be, so one where we have aversion, and on the other side, attachment. And equanimity is like neither of those. So it's sort of in the middle sort of thing. So if you look at that in terms of your own experience, you go like, well, how are you feeling now? And you might say, well, I don't feel incredibly happy, Eddie. There's no great joy there. I'm just sort of sitting here listening to you. I also don't feel any sort of aversion or anger to you. We're just sort of sitting, paying attention. That's equanimity. Just a sort of a neutral type of feeling. That's one way they talk about equanimity. The other type of equanimity is useful in meditation. Now, like I was saying about this particular book here called In Praise of Great Compassion, I think it's the best, it's the most comprehensive. So anyway, I picked it up, started to open up and read it. And lo and behold, what do I find? There aren't three types of equanimity. In fact, there are six. And that's how it is, when you study this material. They come across new stuff all the time. You go, wow, I always thought it was like this. Then you get something really comprehensive by the Dalai Lama, and there it is, everything laid out for you. Go, oh, now that, I like that. You get the whole picture sort of thing. Now, I just found it here, and I'm just going to see if I marked it properly, because one of the great things about this book and all the books in the series is how beautifully it's written. Everything is very condensed, of course, but I'm very, like I said, everything is in it. So we have the virtuous factor we're talking about the mental factor equanimity in terms of meditation. So this mental factor called equanimity, is something that you use yourself to stop yourself applying antidotes. So what I'm trying to say to you is when we try to develop concentration, right? So what we're trying to do is we don't want the mind to be dull and we don't want it to be excited. Now, when it's neither, that's equanimity. And you don't do anything when it's like that. You leave it alone. The mind is resting on its object perfectly. No need to exert any effort. So that was the second type of equanimity. And then the third was the one we talked about and discussed mostly, which is called immeasurable equanimity. And that was our focus last week. And we'll focus on that a little bit today. Let's just see if I can grab that thing again. See where it was. God, look, this is terrible of me. I'm sorry for doing this to you. I find it and I lose it. I find it and I lose it. Let's just leave it there. So we talked about three types of equanimity. I've discovered there's another three more, but we don't need to know about them yet because they're not have to do much with our class. Right? Just know there are a number of different types of equanimity. They differ in terms of the context. And this is not an uncommon thing in the Dharma. We find words that we have an understanding in English, then we find that that's not the meaning they have in Dharma, and they have their meanings change dependent upon the context. Now, the equanimity we discussed last week was the equanimity where we are concerned with removing the bias of attachment and aversion and indifference that we have towards our friends, people we call enemies, and strangers. Now, we want to remove the bias, but we don't need to remove the labels. Right? So there are still people we call friends, enemies, and strangers, or people we call friends and strangers and people we don't like. Right? They still exist. But what we want to remove, like I said, is the bias, what the mind adds to what we call a friend, an enemy, or a stranger, that little extra, the attachment, the aversion, the indifference. The purpose for doing this is to make the mind stable and so that we can develop all these other qualities upon it. They often give the example of, there's two examples I like. One is, when you're about to plant a crop, the first thing you do is you remove all the weeds and the rocks from the ground, right? So, and then you Often we'll get a rake or something and make it nice and even. This is the analogy for this mind, right? We want to remove the rocks and hindrances of aversion, attachment, and indifference. Get the ground up nice and level and plain. Now we can grow the crops. Right? And the crops we want to grow here are love and compassion and this mind seeking enlightenment. Another good example I found is, you know, when you go to paint a house, if you've ever seen people paint a house or you do one yourself, what's the first thing you do? That's right, you clean the walls out, right? You get out there and you start to, this is the idea of equanimity, cleaning the mind up, getting it ready to put the new paint on. So when they do the houses, they often come up with sanders, they wash it all down, they sand it, don't they? You look at it and go, wow, it's all sort of over the place, but hodgepodge. Yeah, you need to get it all down before you put that first paint coat of paint on it. This is the idea here. Okay. So this is the type of equanimity we develop before developing these six causes and one effect to get the mind of enlightenment in this system. And so Lama Tsongkhapa, of course, explains how to develop the mind of enlightenment and equanimity in his text. And I've taken a quote from that text. So here Lama Tsongkhapa says, from the outset, establish an even-minded attitude, eliminating the bias which comes from attachment to some living beings and hostility to others. Otherwise, any love or compassion you feel will be biased. You will never feel unbiased affectionate love or compassion. So cultivate impartiality. So the reason this is, as you can understand here, right? So we already have within ourselves love and compassion. That's already established. We are certainly concerned about our own happiness. That's love. When you're concerned for the happiness of others, that's also called love. We're also concerned about the suffering we experience. We want to avoid it or stop it. But that's compassion. When you want others to be free from their suffering and so forth, again, that's compassion. The problem with ordinary compassion is, what do you think? And what's problematic about that? Repeat again, please, Yvette said. So Yvette says, we have compassion for others we like and we see who are suffering, but we don't have that towards people that we don't like. Okay. What's the problem with that? There's the same thing happens with love, isn't it? Because love's like that. Love is a concern for the happiness of our family members, those close to us, the people we like. Yeah. That type of love is a problem there, and there's also a problem with the type of compassion that Yvette has mentioned. And this is ordinary love, ordinary compassion. Sandy, what's the problem? So Sandy's saying the people are basically, they are suffering and it's out of control. And so others are subject to karma and delusion. Okay, so yeah, I want them to go like, this is the problem, Eddie. Debbie, yeah. Anthea, yeah.
Is it because it's changeable?
Tell me some more, Anthea. What's changeable? Yeah, okay. So someone else just went, that's right. Yeah, now, that's true. Does Anthea come back with something here? Okay. Yeah, so this is a major thing, why this is not so good, right, this bias. Because when the people we love change, we change. You know, the people if you've ever gone through a divorce, right, you start off loving the person you're with, and then one of you changes in such a way that the other goes, I'm out of here. So So suppose we'll just take Sandy and I, right? So we start off in a loving relationship. It's good. Then either Sandy or I does or says something, right? That shows that actually this is not loving behavior. Right? So her behavior changes. So we lose, I lose my love and respect for Sandy. When it's like I said, this bias, when you only focus on the close people, those close people will change. But their behaviors change, right? When their love for us changes, our love for theirs changes, for them changes. We don't keep loving them. So it's very much just like what you said, right? You get aversion to the other person, and all this, who does the aversion hurt? Well, primarily us. If you're going to step out and actually go and physically hurt them, yes, you'll hurt them. Right? No doubt about it, but you're going to hurt yourself too. And so this is the problem with this normal or ordinary, what we call love, compassion, isn't it? Because like you say, if the person that we're looking after is hurting and we try to help them, which we try and do, isn't it often the case that the people we try to help and are hurting behave even a little bit more radical, worse? And ordinarily when that happens, you can just flip out, can't you? Just go like I'm trying to help you and I get this from you. I'm not. Find someone else to help you. Right? So we lose our compassion. That's not stable at all. That's the problem with when it's only directed at a few people. Those few people are going to change. Anthea, it's sort of more like, Anthea, if you have the equanimity as the basis, then it's not going to go be biased. Right? You already start off, you've already moved the bias of attachment and aversion yourself. So when we try to develop our equanimity, is what we norm in the text, it's often going, you wish to be have an equanimous mind. I wish other people had one too. Right? But then then you've got to go, well, okay, but I want this. I have to make my own mind equanimous because I can't depend upon others to do that. You can't even depend upon others to keep loving you, loving us, can we? They don't. They stop. So this is why, like I said, if this is not accomplished, there's no accomplishment of the mind of enlightenment or unbiased love or unbiased compassion. All the other states are unbiased. They're aimed at everybody. The reason it's everybody, because we're trying to become enlightened. Yeah. So that means like it's for everyone. If you leave anyone out yourself, you won't get enlightened. There's some sort of obstruction in your mind, There's some sort of aversion towards them. You're not going to have a mind of enlightenment, are you? Now, really, how most times we talk about the mind of enlightenment, there's a race, we want to know all about that, but it's like we can't get to the top of the staircase unless we stand on the first stair. And this is the first stair. And as you go through it, you'll see it's not such an easy thing to do. In fact, I remember one of the students asking Geshe-la one time. So Geshe, of course, is a Tibetan teacher with about 30 to 40, so he's in 50 years training. Right? And they asked him, said, Geshe, do you have equanimity? And he was sort of really hesitant about answering because, they don't like to sort of do that thing. But anyway, he sort of goes, he's like, not as well as I'd like to. Great understandings of the emptiness and things like this. But this, and then the development, he says, I'm very familiar with the whole course of its practice and engagement and so forth, but do I actually have it? I'm still working. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Oh, it'll help a great deal. And so I'll just say something. So we try to understand their situation. But our understanding of their situation is really based on an understanding of our situation, because that's how you know. You base it on yourself. You go, am I in control of myself? And if you're really serious about this, go, are you always in control of yourself? Are you? You go, you'll end up no. I mean, do you have any control over your body? Very little. You think about how your thoughts just come and go in a cell. You control that? You say, no, it just happened. Yeah, the same with everyone else. Everyone lacks control. And I can't, so my job is, one part of my job now is to, what do you call it, Demi? Reflect what you said. Yeah, and I'm terrible at it, but I'm just learning how to do this. So, okay, so one of the things we need to try and make clear here is, yeah, for a long, long time in the West, there was this thing about empathy, right, that we need to be empathic towards the sufferings of others. Right? And what happened and what continues to happen is people that are in the caring professions burn themselves out. That's just the natural thing of just being empathic, of having empathy. And so we know there's a number of different types of empathy you can extend towards others. This has only come out in the last, 10, 15 years or so? Empathy is a doorway to compassion. If you respond compassionately, you won't burn out. If you respond empathically, you will. That's the difference. So compassion is, like I said, this wish that the suffering stop. That's the ordinary compassion, that you stop suffering. The thing that we all feel towards everybody. Empathy is when we sort of feel their suffering, don't we? We're in tune with it. We feel it and we go, oh, it's terrible. I wish you wouldn't suffer like that. But you start taking home everybody's suffering like that, you go under. So that's the first ordinary compassion here. Mahayana compassion is different again. It builds on it. It adds more. So it says, I see your suffering. I'm going to do something about it. I'm going to stop it. I want it to stop. I want to protect you from suffering. I want to protect you from suffering, and whatever suffering you're experiencing, I want to get rid of it for you. I want to help you get rid of it. Right? So you can see there's some sort of a personal stake in it, something from your side. It's not just the wish, oh, you poor dear, you're suffering. Yeah, I wish that wasn't happening. I mean, that's normal compassion. Buddhist compassion, the Mahayana compassion, sees all that and takes two more steps. Oh, so we've got another term here then. So what I'm trying to point out is that compassion is not sympathy and it's not empathy. These two are different mental states to compassion. I think we sympathize with others suffering. Like I said, compassion is, yes, I acknowledge your suffering and I wish you wasn't happening to you. But sympathy is a bit more like, well, I see your suffering, poor you.
There's a bit of pride to it.
Or like, in a sense, that maybe that I'm not and you are. So, yeah, so few differences here. So the Mahayana, like I said, this compassion they're talking about, it's not only the wish that you're not suffering, but I would like to stop your suffering and I will protect you from suffering. So how do you protect somebody else from suffering? Any ideas? Yeah, but way before, that's true at the end, but way before that, we can do something. Yeah. That's the first thing. That's right. This is saying, you know what to do. That's exactly right. He said, listen. That's right. That's the first thing we meant to do as Buddhists, right? To listen. So what was my question? My question was, yeah, how do we ourselves protect others from suffering? I think it was something like that. Yeah. So we listen, we understand, and then we apply our understanding. Right? So what is the thing to apply here? It's the whole basis of the Buddha Dharma, the basis of all the teachings. No, don't harm them. If you know that, we know compassion is a wish that others do not experience harm, then do not harm them. The first thing to do is hurt them, mate. That's right. Do something. No, that's right. Well, that's pretty good idea. Now, so we need to protect. We protect ourselves by protecting others. It's funny, isn't it? Yeah. In other words, I say, so when we don't swear or curse or get at somebody, the first thing if we don't do that, we're not hurting ourselves. The second thing is you're not hurting them. Now, you might assume that just by speaking bad words to somebody, you're hurting them, but this is not the case. Because there are plenty of people you can speak very harshly to, and they don't respond badly towards you. In fact, they don't even feel bad towards you. So if you think, well, where would that happen? I'd suggest the army. Right? So if you're in the army, you know how they treat you, right? If you've ever seen the movies, there's a lot of very heavy, unkind things to people, and that's why I think, I'd find it very difficult to be in the army, to put up with people yelling in my face and telling me I'm this and that, and I just want to throw my rifle down and walk out, right? Because I'm hurt by their language. But there's plenty of other soldiers that are not, and they don't take it personally, right? So there's no assurance that you using your harsh language to hurt somebody will actually hurt them, even though that's your intention. If it does hurt them, of course, terrible for you, terrible for the other person. If they're not hurt, terrible for you. From Buddhist perspective, for sure. Yep, unequivocal, yes. Yeah. In fact, I was saying to somebody the other day, excuse me, we often have misunderstandings and disagreements with people and so forth. And then if we talk to somebody else about that, often we blame the other person, don't we? We say, well, such and such said this and they did that. Right? And so you say, well, who's at fault here? We go, well, they are, that person. So it dawned on me the other day, really, I said, I've never come across any, in all the books I've read, in all the Buddhist books I've read, I've never come across it where the Buddha says that person is to blame. That persons are never the causes of your suffering. That's what you've got to get your head around, right? If you get around your head around that, like you said, to think about it and work with that, wow, make a huge difference to you. So Buddha says the causes of our suffering are mental defilements, or called afflictions or delusions, and the activities that follow based on them, called karma. They're the things that hurt us, and they hurt other people. It's never other people. So every time we aim at the person, we just go, whoa, now that I've heard this and I think I understand it, right? That's the first thing I should do. If I want to be a compassionate person, the first thing is stop hurting others and yourself. And then we find out, well, how do I hurt myself and others? You know, well, it's through your speech or through some action of your body or the way you think. There's only three ways it can take place. Thank you. I was just looking at this guy. Oh, my gosh. We stayed right here. Okay. So we do need to develop this stuff of equanimity. And it's the equanimity here discussed in the what do you call it? Immeasurable equanimity. Now, immeasurable equanimity comes in a prayer called the Four Immeasurable Thoughts, one of the prayers that we said to begin the class. Right? And these, in brief, we have immeasurable, it started off, so I'll just reflect that back. In our prayer, we started off with immeasurable love, immeasurable compassion, immeasurable joy, and then immeasurable equanimity. So that is the way it's often, and that is a type of equanimity, especially the one at the end. And that's the equanimity that says to get rid of the non-bias and so forth. What the Mahayanists did was they took their four immeasurables, kept them, just reversed them slightly. What they did was they took equanimity from the very end to put it at the very beginning. So that it comes out, you start off with equanimity first to release your attachment, anger, and apathy towards sentient beings. Then they went to love, seeing all sentient beings as our mother, recognizing their kindness, wishing to repay that kindness, and then you end up with affectionate love or heartwarming love. So we've got this friend, enemy, stranger meditation to do of the equanimity. Then we can see we've got seeing all sentient beings as our mother, recognizing their kindness, wishing to repay it. Those three causes end up with this heartwarming, affectionate love. So each effect requires causes and conditions, as you can see here. So after we've developed this love, then we go, it depends because we love another, we don't want to see them suffer. So the compassion arises. They give this example plenty of times with mothers raising children. You know, they say, so imagine you being a mother and this is your only child. Of course, you love this child. Right? And how's this love expressed? Most is like, gee, whenever they suffer, you try and stop it, don't you? You try and do something about their suffering. So you can see it's a natural extension from love to compassion. From there, then it ends up this what's called this great, sorry, the joy, this great resolve in bodhicitta. So what I'm trying to show you here is these seven steps that are contained within the four boundless thoughts. So the practice, like I call the seven cause and effect instruction, on here on equanimity, I've got zero there because it's like the preliminary. Then in the development of the mind of enlightenment, it's primarily love, compassion, and joy. Love having the first four steps, compassion being five, and six and seven, the altruistic intention to develop the mind and that mind itself, they're the last two steps, and it's a sense of joy. So our next step, so what I'm going to put now is these seven steps up there on a table. And just have a look at it, give you a couple of minutes to just look through it. And if you have any questions arising from it, please do. So you just want to read or should I just say some of it to you? What would you like to do? Have a read first, then I can say stuff if you like. Yeah, and if you remember, of course, the slides are up on the web. So you can see here I've put one, two, three, four colors. Right? And the blue one is the equanimity, and like it's a preliminary step. Right? Then we've got one, two, three, four steps developing this affectionate love. And these are the four causes to generate great compassion. But everything before step five is a means to generate great compassion. And afterwards you have great compassion, then you act upon it to develop the mind of enlightenment. So four causes bring about one effect, and the next two causes produce the next effect. So anyway, we have this material here. Just go through a couple of these steps. No, not all of them because we don't have time for all of them. I'm just going to go through, I think, three. But the other ones will be covered in the other modules of the course. So the first question arises in terms of recognize all beings as kin or family. In the Tibetan tradition, they put up recognize all beings as your mother, recognize all sentient beings as your mother. But thank goodness for books like this, you go through it, it doesn't necessarily have to be the mother. But it's got to be somebody that you care for like a great deal. In the tradition, in the Tibetan tradition, of course, they go, well, look what your mother does for you. You got born because of your mother. She fed you before you even born, did all this work. And then now you know, right? Mothers, how mothers look after their children, how much effort is put into that, how much work it is. So you say, look, okay, the mother of this lifetime did all this work for you. You're very, very lucky. But in fact, every person you meet has at one time or another been a mother to you. And they were all as kind to you as the mother of this present life. Right? Now, this is very difficult to get your head around, right? It's the hardest part of this whole seven steps. So the question is, first of all, like, how is it possible that all sentient beings have been our mother? Well, it doesn't seem possible. Anyway, so what I'm going to give you here is a reason for this. And believe me, this reason is not going to suddenly land on you and go, oh, I got it. But, in fact, just only recently I looked at it again. It was like something happened, so I know, oh, maybe I understand it a little bit better, because for quite some time looking at this reasoning, I don't get it. The important thing to remember here is that this is not a literal claim we have to prove. It's really a psychological method. And one of the questions they ask is, if you don't believe this, try and prove to me that one person has not been your mother throughout countless lives. You know, so you can sort of reverse it and give yourself that problem, which is another one. Anyway, I'll show you the reasoning first, huh? All sentient beings have been our mother, first of all. This was developed maybe 20 years ago, brought to a Tibetan Geshe, showed to him and says, does this make sense? And he said, yep, it's a good reason, according to the middle way consequence reasoning. He says, if one being has been our mother within this lifetime, then everybody has been our mother at some time, because everybody is equal. That's the first part. Then the second part goes, if that were not the case, then if one sentient being was never our mother, then no sentient being was ever our mother. He said, why? Because everybody's the same. Everybody's equal. So I know this is probably not going to be anyway. That was accepted as a reason, a middle way consequence reasoning. Now, to do this and come to this conclusion, there's a number of things you have to work out first. And what it is like, how do these phenomena, like called a mother, exist? Because there's one way this could never, ever take place. It cannot take place if you think that a mother has any sort of self-sufficient, substantial existence. If you think a mother exists more than mere name, if you can't, then it's going to be, you can't do it. So you need to have an understanding of the ultimate truth first about persons, then come out with a correct understanding of how people actually exist. If you get that, then this works. If you don't, it won't work. So in terms of us, how a mother conventionally exists, how does a mother conventionally exist? Anybody, any ideas? The mother depends upon, So there, in other words, so Sandy said a mother is somebody you call a mother who has a baby. Is this always the case? No. Yep, that's right. We can have mothers who don't actually give birth, but they care for the other. So they're called mothers. And that's the thing. Like a mother. Called a mother. Right.
Called a
Sure. Someone who's given birth, but then again, it's like you're saying, right? So, in other words, a mother depends upon causes and conditions. Then there's the parts that make up a mother. Then there is someone who's got to have the perception of the person that you're going to call them a mother. It's got to be a correct perception, isn't it? Because you can't do this, but like you said, you're saying, no, there's got to be a baby or there's got to be caring involved. But actually the deepest level of the meaning of mother is merely called mother. Because when you look for a real mother, you cannot find one. And if you use this type of thing to go, I'm looking for real mothers, you have big problems there. There aren't any real mothers. Mothers exist in mere name. Just like you're saying here, right, Sandy, you go, okay, giving birth. But then we go, oh, but what about the caring? And you go, yeah, we'll call that a mother too. So it's given the name. So mothers do not exist from their own side. They're merely called mothers, which is merely called mothers. That's how they actually exist. Of course, this is not how we usually apprehend them. We apprehend them differently. So once you sort of get that, get your head around that, then it makes sense. Otherwise, it just won't. And it can't. It doesn't logically make any sense if the person doesn't exist in mere name. So why the recognition of all beings being our mother? Simply put, to inspire a sense of commonality and solidarity. So every, you know, so you're saying you have this difficulty with people that, you know, you end up hating them. What if you saw them as your mother? And you just remembered all the good things they did for you. Yes, mums do bad things too, but with this stuff, we know that, so we're just going to focus on the good. But why do we just want to focus on the good? About the sense of heart warmth towards our mother, towards the other person, and then recognizing, wow, this person's been really kind to me all my life. I should be kind back. It's only not fair, isn't it? It's the right response. When others are kind to me, doesn't seem right. We should be kind to others. This is that without some strong sense that every being is intimately dear, the traditional sequence of mother, kindness, wish to repay, affectionate love, all the stages, right, has no fuel. It's not going to go nowhere. So this equality and then warmth and then deep concern for their suffering. Just like the normal thing. I mean, there's a number of women here who've raised children, I'm sure, right? So that is, you know, you bring this child into the world, you love them, you care for them. And one of the major things you have to do is just try and, you know, like stop them drinking the Drano. Putting themselves in hot water buckets and things, isn't it? Kiddies, man, can get up to all sorts of problems hurting themselves. And what do mothers do? Stop it. You know, this is what I'm saying. It's the same way you try to protect your child and stop them from harming. This is the compassion that the Buddhas are talking about. Prevent their harm. Stop it. There's more than just watching television and watching people getting blown apart in Beirut, or, oh, you know, poor dears. Well, that's terrible. And many of us just turn it off. Okay, so let's, any questions you'd like to ask here? So one of the students went online, found the book and found the page where I couldn't find the six types of equanimity and said, here it is. So thank you. Thank you, Mandy. This book here is called In Praise of Great Compassion. Great Compassion. It's written by the Dalai Lama and Nun is a very good teacher and translator called Thupten Chodron. Yeah, so I started reading this again this week. I thought, oh, I wish I started on this again. Like, this is really, it's got a lot. And they've got such a great way of explaining the trajectory of the whole path, showing you know, why compassion is so necessary and why it's the basis and the middling and all this stuff. It's really good. Okay, so I know, like I said, this is just the class that introduces this material to you. And that being the case, oftentimes it's difficult to come up with questions if you know, first time hearing or just getting used to it. So let's do a meditation instead, and then we'll keep going with the class itself. So just check your posture, folks, and just try and get comfortable. You want to elongate your back, make sure it's nice and straight, put your hands somewhere comfortable, and just let the body breathe itself. Now bring one person to mind. Okay, now think. This person has been my mother in another life. And when they kept me safe. So recognizing this, shows the long stream of care where countless mothers have guarded your life. Seeing people like this is much like being in a busy city. And in learning, this city is the shared home of my many parents. And if you forget this, then the mind will quickly split people into those on your side and those on that side. Now, when you heard me talk about many lives and does your mind resist this idea? And ask, what's the major cause of the resistance? Now I think, but if the mind did continue after death, then how many so-called strangers have already suffered so much that we could live? And today, or in the near future, choose one small action that you could use to treat a difficult person, looking at that difficult person as a worn out and kind parent. Offer one clear act of kindness or restraint that you offer to your own mother of this life. And finally, as you go about your day, just look around at people and think, you know, you have also carried me. Then act from that thought. And then just breathing in. Exhale, let your eyes flutter open. As you can see, there were a number of different stages. We after acknowledging that all beings have been our mother, what were the next three steps? Can anybody remember? Acknowledging their kindness, wishing to repay kindness, wasn't there? So we recognize our mother, we have to recall her kindness, we resolve to repay the kindness, and then we generate affectionate love. This is the fourth stage. And again, this is from Kamala Shila, from his text, Second Stages of Meditation. He says, moistened by love, your mind becomes like friable, fertile soil. When you plant the seed of compassion, it grows easily and bountifully. Therefore, after you infuse your mind with love, cultivate compassion. So again, this requires, we've got this term love here. So most of us, we hear this term love. I think most of us in the West think of romantic love. But with love, from the Buddhist perspective, it is the wish that the other be happy. So I think, when we are romantically involved with someone, I think we do want the other person to be happy, especially with us. But here you can remove the romantic part and just go, may you be happy. And you go, if you ask, why are you wishing on that? He says, because I want it. That's what everybody wants. There isn't anybody that wants to be unhappy. Everyone would like to be happy. Then we have to look at this word happy and go, what's that word mean? Right? And you're going to find different meanings again. So happy in terms of ordinary happiness, what does that mean? Romantic love, and what else? Yeah, so we're really here talking about the happiness that arises independence upon our senses. So the happiness that we get from eating good food and seeing good food and hearing good music and watching good movies, and being with the people we like and having a healthy body, all these sort of things. So this is a legitimate type of happiness. There's nothing wrong with that happiness. But as you all know, it's not stable, is it? I mean, the food can look lovely, but it can poison you too if it's off. Right? Every one of those objects can also produce suffering. Every object of what we call can make us happy, normal happiness, can also produce suffering. That's one of the Buddhist takes. So you don't need a lot to be happy, actually. And one can be quite happy with less. And in fact, they say the greatest happiness in Buddhism is contentment, is to be content. And this is the how do you become content? Well, you look at the objects of your happiness and look at their nature and go, they're subject to change. They're not stable. They're impermanent. The objects themselves are changing. Then you look at yourself and so am I. And so our relationships with all these objects of the senses are changeable and are changing. And like I say, in the same way that something can produce happiness, it can also produce suffering. Simple as start off drinking, you like a drink, keep drinking, see what happens. You like chocolate cake, keep eating, see what happens. You like being young and looking good, that's great, but something bad could happen. Same, there's also, there's nothing secure about our ordinary happiness. So, but it's a real great stepping stone to greater types of happiness. So, in Buddhism, the happiness they're talking about here is what the happiness you might call nirvana or true cessation, where you no longer have any afflictive stuff in the body and mind. The absence of that is called the happiness of nirvana. Every cause that can create suffering for you is absent. You've put an end to it. You found its cause, you destroyed the cause. So that's a type of happiness. Then there's the happiness of called Buddhahood, where you've done all that for yourself and you can help others do the same. So every time you you found that you really enjoy helping another. This is like the Buddha thing, right? Go further. Help the other person too. So I mean, from this, I'm just going to keep an eye on time here, otherwise, yep. And it's from this great compassion. Sorry, it's from this great love, the fourth stage, affectionate love, or called warm-hearted love. Again, quite difficult. When you read through this material, it takes me aback anyway. I go, oh my gosh, the amount of work I have to do on my mind. Then we come to this great compassion, the fifth stage. So inspiring recognition that all sentient beings deserve to be free from the all-pervasive suffering of samsara. And so when we investigate suffering itself, then you can see actually this can be stopped. If you do that, then you really do get the confidence. Right? Then you go, okay, geez. Just think about it. Any effect depends upon causes and conditions. If the causes and conditions are removed, you cannot have the effect. It's a bit like saying, for Mel, let's say, Mel, you've just won the lottery, right? So what did your winning on the lottery depend upon? Sort of simply, you had to have a ticket. If you didn't have that ticket, you could not claim it. Not only did you have to tie the ticket, you probably had to buy it. You've got to have the ticket, isn't it? If you go up to the office and say, yeah, I've got the ticket. I go, where is it? You actually need a ticket. He's actually got to buy one. And then he's got to have, why'd you buy it, right? So he's got a reason to buy the ticket. So these are what they call causes and conditions. So if you pull away his reason for buying the ticket, the non-buying of the ticket, the non-possession of the ticket, you think he's got the money here? You can't have the money. Oh, sorry, Mel, no money. Right? No result. Same for us. We've got suffering. Right? And then you go, well, that's an effect. That's something. What's it depend upon? You go, well, some causes and conditions. Yeah, oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, what are they? We have to find out what they are. Then you go, well, let's get rid of them. So the effect is not there. It's pretty much as straightforward as that. And it's the same sort of thing with what we call happiness. You go, well, what's the state of happiness like? Does it come and go? You go, yep, then it depends upon causes and conditions. What are they? Okay, I've got to put those in place. I know it's not stable. And I know that. But if I don't put it in place, I'm not going to be happy. Now, this, like I said, this is called great compassion. Because it includes like everyone, right? Because this is what the equanimity did. It took away all the bias and went, right, I'm not just talking about my friends. I'm talking about everybody. I know we're all the same. Everyone wants to be happy. No one is. I'm like that too. Yeah. So it recognized that right across the board. So one of the great thing too here about this is, this is not just about like ordinary suffering. The suffering here is the suffering of just having the human body and mind that is not under our control. That's the level of the suffering they're looking at here. Meaning, all of us age without our ability to stop ourselves, to stop it happening. We can't stop. You come in, we're going to die. We can't stop it. We're going to get sick. Can't stop it. People are going to say things to us that we don't want to hear. That's right. So all these things are called, this is all called suffering because it's not under our control. We can't control all that. And this is what the compassion is directed at. And this really only becomes really deep and for certain is when you look at yourself. Like I said, like many of us are probably quite healthy now, but just recently, the number of people that have developed cancer and all dying around me, there's a few people, right? Like nobody wished that to happen. One, in fact, one of the fellows just died recently. He just had his medical examination. They said, you're all clear, right? Nothing wrong with you. Well, he went away, and next thing, this cancer came from, after. Boom. Now he's dead. Yeah, was it a, yeah, I thought, with that, I thought, I bet you it was the medication. It was just a little weird thing from the medication. Because he said it was quite difficult to take that medication, and he developed pneumonia, and then he passed, right? And I thought, ah, probably the same thing will happen to me. I'll get a pneumonia of some sort. And, there's COVID all around the place, huh? So they're trying to get at this idea of like, just look at yourself. And notice that you can't stop aging, all the health issues, blah, blah, blah. Everybody's like that. That's how deep suffering is. Now this great resolve, this sixth stage. So we recognize this going on with ourselves, this sense of having a lack of control. Then we just go, my wife's like that, my brother's like that. In fact, everyone is like that. Right? Everybody is in the same boat here. So not just do I work for myself, but others, because there's no difference between myself and other. And when you try to look deeply for that thing that makes you different from everybody else, you'll never find it. There's no such thing. That's why. It's just an idea we have. So on the conventional level, yes, lots of differences and so forth. When you deep dive in to look, do I ultimately exist? Does suffering truly exist? No, can't be found. No true suffering, no true person. Again, it's called great because it's like for everybody. Now, one of the things that happened in these classes, I'm teaching, of course, I was a student too, and I still am. Is that my teacher said to me, when you go through these steps, we start off just by starting off with the first is the preliminary equanimity. Then what was it? Well, all sentient beings would be my mother or kin. What was the next one? What was the next one? So you just go through counting to seven. Then he'd say, now go backwards. Start off with the mind of enlightenment. What was necessary before you have the mind of enlightenment? I needed this altruistic intention to become fully enlightened. And what was before that? What drove that? So the great compassion. And what was before that? The great love. And how did you get to have the great love? Well, I wanted to repay the kindness of my mother. So forth. And so you go forwards and backwards. And this is the meditation, right? So remember the word meditation meaning familiarity, the cultivation of cultivating something or becoming familiar with something. So you become familiar with these steps. Like say you sit at a bus stop or at a car or something, you go, look around and go, wow, we're all the same. There's no difference. The person going to work is doing it to be happy. I'm sitting here. I want to be happy. They go to work, they experience problems at work, difficulties, troubles, they experience suffering. Yeah, me too. If I just stay sitting here, my bottom's going to get cold and hard and suffering. But no difference between us. We're the same. Then this person is at one, not right now, of course, but in another life, there's no way I could say this person was actually a mother to me. If I look back right now, there's no way I could say with any certainty they weren't. When they were my mother, they were kind to me, just like the mother of this life. Just like I'd love to do things for my mother now. It's funny, you get older, you remember, you work out how your mum was kind. You'd like to do things, but they're deceased. So it's like, yeah, sure, what I'd love to do good things for my mum. I'd love to repay her kindness. So then you have the affectionate love, warm love. And gee, my mum is suffering, like we all are. I'd like to stop that. I can't stop it. How am I going to stop it? I have to become fully enlightened. I need to become a Buddha. Then I will. That's not anything. So you go like that and say, so when I became a Buddha, what was that depend on? So it's a step back, number six is saying, what was that depend upon? the great compassion. So you go forwards and backwards, forwards and backwards. So you know the steps. And then you can just, like I said, just apply them. Just become familiar with it. Anything interesting? Okay, let's do our last meditation. Okay, again, we just sit there, straighten your back, drop your shoulders, let your body breathe itself. Now, imagine yourself sitting on a seat. Just watching people go by. What do you have in common with the people around you? So there are many things that we have in common. We are all subject to change. None of us has any type of intrinsic nature. But most basically, is that everyone wants to be happy and no one wants to experience suffering. In this way, we're all alike. We're the same. So we develop warm-hearted love, dependent upon recognizing all sentient beings as kin, acknowledging their kindness and wishing to repay their kindness. And before that, our first step was one of equanimity. The equanimity, all beings have been our mother or family member. They have been kind to us when they were that family member. And we want to repay that kindness. Depends upon these steps, we have this great love, warm-hearted love. From that, what's the next step? There's great compassion, this willingness to actually stop the suffering of others, to protect them from suffering. Then the special resolve, where we see that we will have to do this. Can't wait for others, we will help. Recognizing that our help is really limited at present, we need to do something to change ourselves. This is to become fully awakened for their benefit. So if this arises naturally in the mind, we have bodhicitta. Wish to become enlightened for the benefit of others. So perhaps today you might find a real situation in which you can act from the sense of special resolve. You can see others suffering and you act. Rather than letting the habit of indifference overwhelm you. So imagine yourself helping. Think I'll help as best I can. And having said that, and breathe in through your nostrils and exhale through your mouth. Okay. We've come to the end of our class. So in here, there's a number of different questions, those of you who wish to respond to them in our class notes. So here we looked at the equanimity that is developed as the basis for the six causes of one effect meditation. This is the equanimity of friend, enemy, stranger. The meditation we remove our bias. That's the axis of the foundation. Then there were the six causes and one effect. And that's what we've mainly talked about. We just talked about a few of the causes today. This quite a lot of information written on great compassion. Of course, it's really seen as the whole basis of the Mahayana vehicle. So if you can, find something by the Dalai Lama or Lama Zopa Rinpoche. Of course, if you have your own guru already or teacher, we'll rely upon them and have a look at their teachings. So if you can, try and do this if you want to. Just memorize these steps, you know, go equanimity. Then I got these seven things. They're not going to go backwards. And then as you become, you know, it doesn't take long to do this. You'll get it. And then what you want to do after that is go, okay, now I've got all these up. What do they mean? How do I do them? When can I do them? You know, then you can sort of, okay, ask more questions, have a look at more books. Think, okay, if I want to do this, here's how I can do it. Like I said, in this particular book, there are meditations, and also in Widening the Circle of Love, there are very good meditations too. Again, just remember, meditation just means I'm just trying to become familiar with these ideas. Just start there. Remember, we're just learning, and don't put too so much pressure on yourself that you don't do anything at all. Next week, we're going to be talking about developing equanimity in another way through the 9 points that are often discussed in the Equalizing Exchanging Self with Others. Now, this 9-point meditation was given to His Holiness by his tutor. And so I'll share it with you next week. Okay, so let's dedicate now. So dedication here means that, you know, we've all expended mental energy, verbal energy, physical energy, just sitting here listening, trying to engage in the stuff. So let's, we have a purpose for being here. Let's aim the energy that we've developed towards that purpose. So join me in saying, due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings, without exception, into that enlightened state. Bodhicitta, may the supreme jewel, Bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. In the prayer for the long life of His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, the wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And lastly, the prayer for Rinpoche's swift return. In holding and spreading the Muni's precious and complete teachings through explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience that is never discouraged. Incomparable Venerable Guru, to you I make this request. Well, thank you, everyone. Please join us upstairs for some lunch if you'd like. There's tea and refreshments.